Our next speaker of the afternoon is Michel Boileau, who will be talking about one of Bill's favorite subjects, cyclic branch coverage of knots and the characterization of S3.
Thank you. So it's a great privilege to be here and to talk for this conference in honor of Bill Thurston. So I want to say a few words. It's clear that the work of Bill was very influential for many geometers in France. And I was talking with William Abikoff, and the adventure started in 76, 77 in Orsay, when there was running this seminar about diffeomorphism of surfaces. It was running by Lodenbach, François Lodenbach, Albert Fatty, Valentin Poenaru, Adrien Douady, and that was a wonderful seminar for students. And the second shock, I will say, in the adventure is when Larry Siebenman came back in 78 with the knots. I will say the first on knots about hyperbolic geometry, and he just say us, there was Bonawan and other students, he just say us, okay, now you have some subject thesis. Don't bother me anymore about that. So, and Sullivan was around, was lecturing about Kleinian group. Norbert Acampo, he was from singularity theory, but decided to give a lecture about hyperbolic geometry, and many things was going on. And in 79, there was this Bangor conference about topology. I guess some, at least Bob Edwards was at this conference, where Thurston was explaining his program. And he said a few things. I hope I remember well. He said first, I will propose a conjecture which is more interesting than the Poincaré conjecture because it concerns all the manifolds, and it's better to take care of infinitely many people than only one. And the second thing he say, you know, perhaps in 30 years, all the program will be done. And I was a student, I think, oh, 30 years, it's a very long time. Now I think it's a short time, not very. And then he was lecturing about this skinning map. I say I cannot understand a word except that there was a leopard spot on the blackboard. And this was the beginning of the story for me, learning about Thurston works. And I bring something here, which perhaps people remember. This is the flow chart for this monster theory, theorem, hyperbolization theorem. So that's what we discovered as a student that we have to learn all this. And when I saw on the announcement, what next? I must say I am slow. I have not even turned the first pages. And today I will speak of a very special cases of, I guess, this, let's see, this one. small boxes. So it's amazing. Amazing what is that. So I want to speak about some particular case of orbifold. It's a very basic orbifold. We can call it not orbifold. So I will just recall some definition. And it's a joint work with Clara Franchi. She is from finite group theory. And Mattia Mecchia, Luisa Polozzi, and Bruno Zimmermans are not theorists. So orbifold is a natural generalization of manifold, and I think they were known or studied in complex geometry. And they can be roughly described as spaces which locally look like the quotient of a manifold by a finite group. So they were introduced by Satake, and the first name was V-manifold. And you can find it even in Bourbaki. There is a small Bourbaki book about manifold, and he called it V-manifold. But I think their importance in dimension three really is due to the seminal work of Thurston. We introduce it first clearly to study finite group action, and in particular at this time there was this a Smith conjecture about whether the cyclic action on the sphere are orthogonal, but also as a tool for geometrizing manifolds. He wanted to deform this kind of structure. And as I say, they occur in many contexts, orbit space of group, that's what I will use here, or leaf space of foliations. So in dimension three, an orbifold is just a metrizable space. Each point has a neighborhood which is modeled on one of these balls. So you take a ball and you take the quotient by a finite subgroup of SO3. So here it's a true ball, there is no, it's not a singular point. Here you have just a cyclic group, and here you have one of this finite group acting on SO3. So here the branching index has to be special in some sense. So what you want is that this to be spherical. I will focus in the talk on this simple kind of orbifolds. Okay. So a classical way to construct free manifold, and I guess it goes back to Higgard, was by taking cyclic covering or branch cyclic covering of S3 branch along a knot. And I will call the n-fold cyclic covering MNK. And it has a diffeomorphism which acts of order n, which corresponds to the covering translation. And according to Thurston point of view, then the quotient is an orbifold. And it's better to see, to look to the orbifold, because it's a compact space. And the underlying space will be S3. The singular locus will be a knot. So for orbifold in general, you have a trivalent graph. But here you have just a circle, but a knotted circle. And the local model, as I say, are this football. That means this quotient of the ball by a cyclic group. So you have this projection, quotient space. It corresponds to an orbifold n-fold cyclic cover. So you can do for orbifold what you do for manifold. There is the same kind of theory. And for the lecture, I will say that the covering translation is a hyperelliptic rotation of M. And the goal of the lecture will be, in some sense, to study how many hyperelliptic rotations can a manifold carry. That will be the goal of the lecture. So I recall the Thurston orbifold theorem. If you take a compact orientable free orbifold without bad two suborbifold, you have perhaps to explain what is a bad sub two orbifold. So that's a two-dimensional orbifold, which is either a drop or you have two cone points. So this is a P and this is PQ, and P is different from Q. Okay, so in some sense, this is one is simply connected, which is not the sphere. And if P and Q are prime, relatively prime, this is simply connected and it's not the sphere. And so if you avoid to find in your free manifold, in your free orbifold, such a bad two orbifold, then you have a decomposition along a finite collection of spherical and essential Euclidean two orbifold. So now, before we would have to say orbifold with non-trivial singular locus, but now due to Perelman proof of the geometrization for manifold, this theorem works in a full generality. One consequence of this theorem, which is in some sense wonderful, is show you that if you take an orbifold, you avoid this bad two suborbifold, you have a finite cover which is a manifold. So in some sense, you draw a trivalent graph in the plane. You put the right, at the vertices, the right number, in some sense, which are allowed to have a spherical vertices. And you just avoid this bad stuff. Then, you know, you have a group. You take the complement of the graph and you add the relation, which take kilo power of the meridian, and this group is very nice. It will be residually finite. It will be virtually torsion-free. It will have all the property you want. So it's a big machinery to build very good and very nice group, in some sense, this theorem, in explicit way. So I will apply this theorem just for the case of this knot orbifold. And if you take a knot and you look to the cyclic branch fault covering, then you have a decomposition into geometric piece where the covering translation acts equivariantly. So if your order of the covering is strictly bigger than 2, then you see that there is a very strong relationship between the geometric decomposition of the complement of the knot and the geometric decomposition of the cyclic fault covering. Because in some sense, you cannot, you know, the fixed point can never meet some of the tori. So the tori that you see in the cyclic branch cover will go down in the complement of the knot. The case n equal 2 is the most difficult case, in some sense. Because then the relationship is not direct, because you may meet the tori, and it will put downstairs some Conway spheres. So you have to be... Then this is amazing. If you're not as a complete hyperbolic structure, then for n bigger or equal to 3, and if you accept this figure 8 knot, which is the favorite knot of Alan and Montesinos, because before being the only arithmetic knot, it was the first universal knot. And then you get a complete hyperbolic structure on the cyclic branch cover. So that gives you an easy way to get a lot of hyperbolic manifold. And also it shows you that you have a rigidity. So that's what we want to explore, that you know, this hyperelliptic rotation must be isometric. Okay. And you will have finitely many if your manifold is hyperbolic. And then the Smith conjecture, that if k is unknot, if and only if, sum of its finite cyclic cover is S3. So if you fix, if you take this cyclic n-fold cyclic cover, that you have m, you have k, the knot, and you have n. And there is some strong relationship. First, if you give m and k, then it will determine n when n is prime. In fact, it will determine n. You have just, I put n prime because you have to avoid this, some cases of iterated torus knot, where you may have some problem. And in some sense, now you can say, okay, I give m and n. So what happened? So how many knots can have the same n-fold cyclic cover? And this is also really rigid in some sense. See, if you give m and you take also an odd prime number, there is at most 2 knots with the same n-fold cyclic cover. But which is perhaps more interesting, this situation will occur for at most 2 odd prime. So if you take 3, 5, 7, and you know that in between this number, for any knot, it will be determined by one of these cyclic branch cover, in some sense. So you have a kind of rigidity there. And now you can say, okay, I am old enough, so I can just forget about k, n, and just look to m. And the question will be, if I fix m, how many knots can have m as an n-fold cyclic branch cover? No, this 2 odds, that the prime depends on the manifold. But for any manifold, there is only 2. But the prime number will depend on the manifold. A natural question will be, in some sense, to classify up to conjugacy the possible presentation of a manifold as a cyclic branch cover. So a property of the standard sphere is to admit hyperelliptic rotation of any order. And due to first-order manifold theorem, that's the only manifold with this property. In the sense that if you fix a manifold, there are only finitely many knots such that M is a cyclic branch cover along the knot. But a priori, the number of knots depend on the manifold. And if M is different from S3, the possible degree is branched, bounded by a constant, which depends on the manifold. But we have example, for example, for n equal 2, you have example of manifold, which have, in some sense, you fix a big N, then you can find a manifold, which is a two-fold branch cover of big N different knots. And these manifolds are ciphered manifolds. So in general, the number of knots can be arbitrarily large. And this is the example, if M is not prime, you can do it by connected sum. Or when N equals 2 and M is not hyperbolic. And for hyperbolic manifold, you have this very nice result of Marco Reni, that there is at most 9 hyperelliptic involutions. And the proof is really relies on the theory of finite group. And it's a nice result because when you look to the theory of finite group and the classification of simple group, what causes problem is the two Silo subgroup. That's where the problem comes. And if you have involution like that, hyperelliptic involution of order 2, then you have two Silo subgroup. And this bound is sharp, but I don't know an example, explicit example. So it's a kind of indirect proof. So you build an example which is not hyperbolic, and then Kaoshi has this imitation theory. So he says, if you have a manifold, and if you have a finite group action on it, I can realize it the same group acting on a hyperbolic manifold. And so I don't know an example, I must say explicitly. So the theorem I want to talk about is the following. I restrict to reducible free manifold. And I say that if I look to such a manifold which is not homeomorphic to S3, then there will be at most 6 hyperelliptic rotation of odd prime order. So we expect free. The number has to be free, but we are not able to get it. So this theorem, in some sense, this theorem will give you, if you think about a finite group acting on a manifold, it will give you some restriction on the action. We know that any finite group can act on a hyperbolic manifold, even freely. That's a result of Daryl Cooper and Darren Long. But this kind of result shows that it cannot act in any way. So for example, it cannot contain more than 6 hyperelliptic rotation. And so the straightforward corollary will be that if you have a closed, orientable, connected, irreducible free manifold, then it will cover at most 6 distinct knots.
Question.
Yeah?
Why
to cover S3, you mean?
Yeah, can't you replace S3 by anything?
No. I will have to say. No. If it's not covering S3, for example, you have to think about the Briscorn sphere.
these are, I mean, with n exceptional fiber. These are ciphered manifold which base a sphere and you have these n points, P1, Pn. And the Pi are, say, prime. And in fact, you can choose odd prime. And relatively prime, so distinct. So this is an homology sphere, for example. You get it by a complete intersection in the theory of singularities. And here you have as many rotation of order pi 1, pi 2, pn. But the quotient is not S3. The case where the quotient is S3 is when you have the genuine Brisson spheres with three exceptional fiber. Okay? So in general, and we will use it in the proof in a very strong way, that the quotient has to be S3. So I will try to explain where this happens. So we can use, you know, if the manifold is not irreducible, then you have a decomposition as a connected sum of prime manifold, and this decomposition will be equivariant by any of this hyperelliptic rotation. And then you get that a close connected orientable free manifold is homeomorphic to S3 if and only if it admits 7 hyperelliptic rotation. So you have a kind of a uniform bound. And that's what I was saying. The requirement that the rotation are hyperelliptic is essential because you have this Brisson homology sphere which has met n rotation in some sense. So you cannot avoid this assumption. So in fact, and that's one of the features of the geometrization theorem. You can use this geometric decomposition and the uniqueness of the geometric decomposition to reduce the proof of such a result to the finite group case. In some sense, if you prove it for the finite group case, then when you have the general case, you start with your, for example, 7 hyperelliptic rotation, and you look the group, say, generate, but the group acting on the GSG graph. But the GSG graph is a finite graph, so the group of action on this graph is finite. And then you can use the finite case here. So there is a way to reduce the proof for the irreducible manifold case to the proof for a finite subgroup of diffeomorphism of M. And that's where you get that this result gives you some restriction on the way that such a finite group will act on the free manifold. So the point is that in the proof, it will strongly use, that's an interesting point perhaps, strongly use the finite group theory and even the classification of simple group. But you cannot only use that, you know. You have to use also the geometry, because any finite group acts on a free manifold. So you have to both use this result. So, okay. So here is just a corollary, if you combine with Marco Reni, that if you take a hyperbolic manifold, then if you look to covering, cyclic covering with prime order, you have at most 15 knots. And I certainly guess that you never get 15 knots, but certainly less. But this method is not giving for the moment. So as I say, an interesting aspect of the proof is to use a finite group theory and this classification of finite simple group. So The proof will split in various cases. There is a little of botany in it. According to the structure of the normalizer. So what is important is the P silo subgroup. So I have a hyperelliptic rotation of order P in my finite group. It will belong to some P silo subgroup, or P silo subgroup are conjugated, and the game will be to show that the other possible hyperelliptic rotation will commute with the one. No, not a link. No, it will not work. It does not work for a link. Yeah, yeah. No, you will see. Okay. What we use is this, and what is used in the classification of finite simple group is the P-silo subgroup. Here, you know, if you have a rotation, I mean, if you have a hyperelliptic, but just a rotation. So I mean a finite diffeomorphism with a connected fixed point set. Then the P-silo subgroup will be rather simple. And that's what we use. And then after, we try in some sense to show that if you look to another hyperelliptic rotation, it will have to commute with this one. So the idea was, if the P-silo subgroup is simple, for example, it will be abelian, then we will look to the normalizer of this P-silo subgroup. And you will have to try to show that the normalizer is big enough so that you can conjugate the other hyperelliptic rotation in it. But at every step we use, you know that it's hyperelliptic. And we use that it's an odd prime. My guess is that if you are good enough in finite group theory, and certainly not me, what you have to avoid, that's clearly that's a power of two. But perhaps you can do the finite group result for example, just elements which are relatively prime integer. However, if you want the general result, when the manifold has a non-trivial GSG decomposition, then having prime it's help a lot. Because you have to look to the action on the graph, GSG tree. And then if it's prime, either it's fixed, or I mean the orbit of a point is either the point or P point. And then for the general case, it's all. So we have to look to various cases according to the structure of the normalizer of the P-silo subgroup, which contains this hyperelliptic rotation of odd prime order P. And in fact, the structure of the normalizer, you know, if you normalize this P-silo subgroup, in some sense, you can show that more or less you normalize this rotation, this hyperelliptic rotation. That will give you symmetry on the quotient or bifold. So the case, you can follow the case geometrically in some sense, or looking to symmetries of this orbifold downstep. So if J is a finite group, one can choose a Riemannian metric on M which is invariant by G, and then you have that the normalizer of a hyperelliptic rotation must leave the circle of fixed points of phi invariant. And so you deduce from that the normalizer of this hyperelliptic rotation is a finite subgroup of this semi-direct product of Z2 by an abelian group of rank 2. So what you can do on the circle, if you can twist like that, twist around in some sense, or invert the circle. That's the only thing you can do. And the element of order 2 acts by sending each element of the product to its inverse. And the element of the normalizer are precisely those that rotates about the fixed point set, or it's translate, or it's inverse the fixed point set. Okay. So you have a very simple silo, P-silo subgroup in some sense. And it has a geometric interpretation. And here is one of the lemma that if you look to the P-silo subgroup of J, which contains hyperelliptic rotation, then it's either cyclic or of rank 2 abelian. And you can deduce from that the normalizer of your silo subgroup is solvable. In fact, it contains an abelian subgroup of index at most 4 in some sense. The first claim follows from the fact that you show that the silo subgroup is exactly the normalizer of this hyperelliptic rotation. But you have to use some result about P-silo subgroup in some sense. It's not a direct. So what are the steps of the proof? The first step is to prove the result for a solvable finite group. And you may ask why it will work for solvable fundamental group. And the only answer I can give you, roof answer like that, is nilpotent groups are nearby solvable. And if you look to a nilpotent finite group, it's a product of its silo subgroup. Okay? Each of your hyperelliptic rotation will be in a silo subgroup. And if it's a product, they commute. And we will see that when the hyperelliptic rotation commutes, then we can have at most 3 of them commuting. This is the second step when you have deal with this solvable group, it's a kind of topological argument. We will cover the group by solvable subgroup. So we have this notion of solvable normal cover of the finite group, which is a collection of solvable groups. So you take a non-solvable finite group, you take the set of odd prime dividing G. So G must have, you know, the order of G cannot be odd. Otherwise, this is the Feit-Thompson theorem. The group will be solvable. A collection of solvable subgroup will give you a solvable normal P cover. If whenever you have, if every element of prime order belongs to one of these subgroups. So the idea is your group is not solvable, but I can cover it by solvable subgroup and conjugate of solvable subgroup, such that if I any hyperelliptic rotation, it will be in one of these subgroups. Okay? And you know, as I said, in a solvable subgroup, you can put at most 3 hyperelliptic rotation. So if you show that the smallest number of conjugacy class of solvable normal P cover is 2, then you get the fundamental equality that 2 multiplied by 3 equals 6. And that's the idea of the proof in some sense. So first prove it for solvable group, and then show that you can cover your group in general by a few solvable group. So in particular, among simple groups, you have this linear simple group. And for this linear simple group, the bound you get is exactly 2. So here is a proposition for a finite solvable group. You assume the manifold is not S3. If J contains more than or 3 hyperelliptic rotation of odd prime order, then you show that they must commute. And the argument will be the argument I gave you for nilpotent group in some sense. Except here, you know, the group is not the product of your silo subgroup. But if the silo subgroup is big enough, it will be a semi-Dirac product. And you can use that for to show the conjugacy. Then the second step is that up to conjugacy, you show that J contains at most three hyper-elliptic rotation. And the idea there is, you know, your hyper-elliptic rotation commute, you choose one. Okay. It gives you a knot in S3. Since the other commute with this one, it will give you axial symmetry for the knot downstairs. And it's a proposition that a knot cannot have too many axial symmetry. That comes from the Smith conjecture, which tells you that the finite diffeomorphism group acting on a knot space must be cyclic or dihedral. So in fact, here, so this is something, we prove also that the order are pairwise distinct, or if you have the same order for both, for two, there is at most two such conjugacy class. And the idea is, if you have four commuting hyperelliptic rotation, then as I said, you fix one, you have this covering projection branch along the knot, which is the image of the fixed point set, and the three remaining rotation will give you rotational symmetry of K, and you can show that a knot which admits three full, I mean, and that's where we use that the quotient, that the rotation hyperelliptic. Full means that when you have this symmetry, the quotient of the knot is trivial. You may have symmetry where the quotient of the knot is not trivial. But here I want the quotient of the knot is trivial. So if you have a knot which has free symmetry like that of order which are pairwise distinct and bigger than two, and then it must be the Ian knot. In fact, we don't need this result. We don't need here. It will be a little simpler in the sense that the three remaining rotations, they commute. So you can use this directly. If you want to prove that, then you have to work more. But that's why we believe that three will be the maximum. And in some sense, we can build example with three. But it's difficult to build example with more than three. Because to build example with three, the idea is you know, if you want to build knots which have the same twofold, the same n-fold, I will say P and Q, then you take, I don't take this, this is too simple. I don't take the off link, but I take a link with two components, but unknotted component. I take a ramification P over that, and this component will give me a knot. And ramifying over Q, this gives me a knot. And then these two knots have the same Q fold for that, P fold for that branch covering. Then you have to do it with three. But if you are clever enough, you can do it. But then that means that you have, in some sense, if you want to do it, you have to start with upfling then. And you know, the what you have is that if you have a cyclic group acting on S3, it has at most two fixed points. And the two circles of fixed points will give you an upfling. So you have to build the example starting from that. Or if you like the algebraic geometry in some sense or singularity theory, then you can build example by taking this Briscorn sphere with three cone points. So, as a corollary, in fact, if you have a Z homology sphere, you can go down to three and not six. And that comes from the fact that finite group acting on homology sphere, Z homology sphere, are special. So on that you have restriction, which allow to show that 3 will be the right number. And this number is realized by this Briskon sphere, and you can do it by hyperbolic manifold too. And this is expected to be the maximal number in any cases. So perhaps I will just explain the Z-homology spheres, which is the simplest to explain. So it's boiled down directly to classification of group acting on integral homology spheres. Then the crucial lemma is if you have an integral homology sphere and you have a finite subgroup of diffeomorphism on M, which contains a rotation of order bigger or equal to 7, then it must be solvable. And if it's solvable, you use a solvable case, and you get 3. And for that, perhaps I will. Oops, no, it was too quick. Mechia and Zimmermann, they give a list of a finite group acting on the integral homology sphere, which are not solvable. And as you know, when you have integral homology sphere, that is the group A5, which is always occurring. So either you have the group A5. So the classification for free action was given by John Milner, much before than that. And even in this case, there was this tricky stuff with the action that you must have some involution in the group. Here you get this list of finite group. And C in the list will be solvable. It has a unique involution, and this involution will act freely on M. And this product by Z over by Z2, it's a central product. And from this list, in some sense, no, this is one. If J is not solvable, and it cannot contain a rotation of prime order bigger or equal to 7, or we are in the least case. So if it contains a rotation of order bigger or equal to 7, we must be in this case. Because for the other, there is no element of order 7. But the rotation of prime order, which is bigger or equal to 7, must be contained in the solvable factor. But the element of the solvable factor, they act freely. So it's not possible. So in this case, modulo this classification, but which is not too difficult to obtain, you get the answer. So the general case will be a case-by-case analysis. And we're using the structure of the maximal semi-simple normal subgroup. So when you have a finite group, you have a maximal subgroup of odd order. You take the quotient by that. And then you look in your finite group, what is the maximal semi-simple normal subgroup? So perhaps semi-simple means that it's a perfect group, and the factor group by the center are product of non-abelian simple group. And that's where the classification of simple group come in the picture. So what happens is, roughly speaking, either you know that there are at most 6 conjugacy classes of hyperelliptic involution, or you show that this for some normal, solvable normal cover, the maximum number of conjugacy class of solvable group is smaller or equal to 6. And then you can tell me, but 6 multiplied by 3, because in each of these solvable group, I have at most 3 hyperelliptic rotation is 18. So it's not the right number. So that means that you have to work a little more. And it happens when this number is bigger than 2,
it happens that on each of these normal subgroup, you have only one, a conjugacy class. So, and in some sense, I mean, there is a dichotomy in the proof, and the easiest case will be when your knot has no symmetry. Then, you come to the case where the knot has a symmetry. That means he has an axial symmetry, which goes down. You look to the knot and the axis. And the good case is when this link is not exchangeable. You cannot exchange the axis and the knot. Because that means that the normalizer of this hyperelliptic rotation stays small. And the really bad case is when all the knots you consider for the hyperelliptic rotation, they are exchangeable. And then really you have to go through the classification of simple free group, simple finite groups. So you have to withdraw all these sporadic groups. And then you have to deal with this AN group. And then you come to this Lie type group. And that's so it's kind of not really easy proof. So the question, first the question is, I guess that free is a sharp bound. I am not sure that the approach via finite group theory will give free. So we have to find a different approach. And for me, perhaps, I can put the question. For me, perhaps the different approach will be to look to these commensurability classes of RB4. So, you know, looking if two knots have the same cyclic branch cover means that you are asking if the orbifold ONK and OMK prime are commensurable. But it's a more difficult question because, you know, they can be commensurable but with not the same finite cover. Here we fix in some sense, in the question I was looking here, we were fixing the manifold M and we were looking to and so on. And we shown in some sense that if this number P1, P2, PQ are odd prime, you have at most 6, which follows that. Now, if you look to the commensurability class, it may change the M. It's not the same M. But you can expect that there is perhaps only finitely many of these orbifold, which are simple orbifold, which are commensurable. And perhaps there is a uniform bound on the number also. And perhaps it's free, too. But this is a... and also, for hyperbolic manifold, you can expect that there is a uniform bound on the number of all, I mean, conjugacy class of hyperelliptic rotation without any assumption on this order. I will not say that it's free. This I don't believe, but I think it's conceivable to get a uniform bound in this case. Then finite group theory can tell you something, perhaps, in this way. In the sense, for example, that, you know, in the argument in the finite group theory, the fact that you have a odd prime was used, but perhaps not in an essential way. It was more essential to pass from the finite group to the general manifold with non-trivial GSG decomposition.
Thank you, Michel. Are there any questions for the speaker?
Your branch cover over a question.
Yeah, let's perhaps give a contract.
Did you repeat the question, please?
It was a question of using, in some sense, you have a bridge presentation of the knot. You lift it, it gives you an equivariant Higgard splitting that in some cases you can realize by some minimal surfaces in the hyperbolic cases. And so if you have many knots, you have many of these surfaces. And perhaps it's not possible at some point in the hyperbolic manifold related to the volume or the injectivity radius or something like that. So that will be a nice way to do it in some sense. The problem is effectively that you have to forget about the Seifert case because then you can have many. And how you use that it's hyperelliptic. On the surface because you say that it comes from a bridge presentation. But you have to use and then perhaps the meridian. You have to use something which tells you that it's hyperelliptic. Otherwise, it does not work. Something like that will be more conceptual for me even. So finite group theory is very nice. You learn a lot, but... the argument is really case by case. And what was perhaps nice, in some sense, is that, you know, the proof for the classification, you start, the first bit is this Faye-Thompson theorem. Okay, if it's odd, it's solvable. And then you look to when the two silo subgroup has a small rank. But if you take a manifold which is a Z2 homology sphere, then for any finite group acting on it, the two silo subgroup has rank smaller or equal to 4. And then you have a classification by Ihara and Gorenstein, which is simpler than the full classification. So in some sense, there is a kind of dictionary that you can follow even in the proof. So that's what I like. But I will prefer a geometric way of understanding what happens.